Oh, Lakshman's wife.
Yes. Sita's sister and Lakshman's wife. I'm just Dasi. Okay, February 5th, 2010, in Mayapur. Process of surrender here with our Bhakti Shastri class. So, I was able easily to find that quote of Bhaktivinoda Thakur because I had it in my nectar folder.
Wow.
Yes, you did.
That's if I remember to copy paste and make a file and put it in my nectar folder, then I can find things easily. It's in the, where is it? Chaitanya Sikshamrita. And he says that if you're at the end of your life, three times when you shouldn't take on a big project. Three circumstances under which if you take on a big project, then it's like motive. He didn't say motive passion, but he says it will be a hindrance to bhakti, and it's considered in the area of over-endeavor. So I think we can safely say that that would be in the category of motive passion. One is when you're going to leave your body pretty soon. Don't take on a great big project when you're really, really old. Another is don't take on a big project that requires a lot of money if you have no money to begin with. And don't take on a project that requires a lot of manpower if you have no way to get manpower. So, those are pretty simple things. In other words, what principles he's saying? That something's over-endeavor and a hindrance to bhakti if you don't really have the means.
And it's amazing how Prabhupada transcended all of
that. Well, I was thinking about that. And in one sense, he didn't. Because Srila Prabhupada started, he did do things in his old age. But Prabhupada didn't start out with a big project. In other words, he didn't start out saying, okay, let's build a temple in Mayapur with no money and no manpower. And at first, Prabhupada just sat in Tompkins Square Park and played cartels. So he had plans, but you see that, and he had a vision, but you see that Prabhupada actually only did things when there was at least something to start out with. There had to be at least some people or some money. Because I was thinking about this in terms of the project I'm working on now, because I thought for a long time that I couldn't start a curriculum project unless I had a lot of money and a lot of manpower. I thought first I've got to have, you know, like $10 million and 200 people to do what I want to do, which will take about, the whole plan I want to do will take about 10 to 20 million a year and about 200 people full time. And then what I finally goodbye. What I finally decided was that instead of waiting till I get that much money and manpower, which I may never get, I was saying I can't do anything till I get that. I thought, what can I do with what I have? Which was quite, it's quite different. I thought, is there some part, and Anutama, who's here right now, he gave me some good advice. He said, do something that you can accomplish in a relatively short amount of time without a lot of people or a lot of money, and that stands by itself as a completed project, and yet can also be built on. So that's exactly what I did. And I started something that required only me, a desk, a chair, and an internet connection, and my computer. That was all I required. And, you know, a little bit of kitri every day. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it didn't require much. I didn't really need money or manpower at all. And I worked on that for quite a while. And then a devotee approached me and said, I would like to do I'd like to do this curriculum project. And he said, and I'm willing to put some money into it. And he didn't have a whole lot of money. You know, at that time, he just put in maybe 500 pounds. The whole project is going to be, you know, the cost of the whole project, if we look at volunteer hours in terms of money, probably about 300,000 US dollars for the whole project. If we had to pay people, because a lot of things have been volunteered. But, you know, he offered some money to start. So I did, immediately I had some manpower. I had somebody else offering to help, and I had somebody else offering some money. So I said, okay. So then I just did a little bit. You understand? I just did as much as he had money for. Then from there I traveled And one of the places I traveled, somebody handed me $10,000 and said, here, this is for whatever project you want to do. Well, boom, I had enough to pay all the artists. All of a sudden, I had enough to pay artists for all the books. So I didn't engage artists until I had the money to pay them. I didn't engage artists thinking, you know, I'm going to have them. I waited till I had the money. So I think that's the kind of... I tried to look at Prabhupada's example in terms of what I'm doing. So you see that Prabhupada, he made a plan, but he just did a little piece of it. He just did whatever piece he could do with the money and manpower that he had. Or at least he had some indications of having some money. So I think that's different than, you know, saying, okay, I need to have the full amount of money before I don't think Bhaktivinoda Thakur was saying that. Well, the principle that I get from him is if you're trying to do something where you have absolutely no means at all to do it, then that's going to hinder your bhakti. And one devotee was recently telling me how her husband wants to do a certain project, and he's thinking he can't do it unless he gets a huge amount of money, but she said he's trying to control every aspect of it. I say, that doesn't work. What you do is you do what you can do now with what you have now, and then if Krishna sends more, then you expand, and if Krishna sends more, then you expand, and Krishna sends more, then you expand. See, what can I do with the resources that I have now? And you can have some plan for expansion. As soon as somebody gave me that $10,000, I knew what to do with it. I already had a plan. It wasn't like I hadn't said, no, what do I do with this? I knew exactly what to do with it. Well, I think a lot of us, if somebody handed you, you know, $10 million, you'd have to sit down and say, now, what am I going to do with this? So I already knew exactly what I wanted to do. So I'm seeing it more like that. So things that are way beyond your capacity. It's like if I said, okay, I'm going to make a full-length Hollywood movie on the Mahabharata. I think, yes, in English. I don't think I'd make a film in Thai, so yeah, I think it'd be in English. One of my students produces movies in Thai. Anyway, but I don't have the means. I don't have the training. I don't have the contacts. I don't have the money. I don't have the manpower. So that would definitely be a hindrance to my bhakti.
Just preach to Steven Spielberg.
Preach to Steven Spielberg for half an hour. I tried. I actually did spend a half an hour preaching to some director. There was some director who'd made a movie that had some like sort of quasi-spiritual elements in it, and some devotees contacted me, and evidently this producer had some friend who knew me. I don't remember all the details. This was a long time ago, like 20 years ago. And they said, you know, this guy might be willing to talk to you on the phone, so I called him up. And so they heard you made this movie, and it was about this and this and this, and, you know, would you be interested in talking about developing a spiritual theme? And his response was, well, he said, I can't even talk about that kind of thing unless I see a script. And then he was telling me what was involved with writing a script that would be acceptable. Yeah. And I kind of looked at it and thought, and then he told me what were the chances and what would be involved and the whole thing. And again, I looked at it and said, well, yeah, I don't really know if I can do that. So I sort of put that aside. Anyway, does that help at all?
Yeah.
We had a whole discussion. So I think that we can sort of add that to the another factor to look at. And I think that's very connected with the sort of things that I was saying, that if you do some service where your whole life gets out of balance, and I sort of see that in very much in what Bhaktivinoda Thakur is saying, if you're taking something up where you don't have the means to do it, then in order to try to do it, you're going to have to put your life, he doesn't say that, but I'm extrapolating, you're going to have to put your life out of balance. You're going to have to do something way beyond your capacity to try to accomplish it. And then things are going to get out of balance. I think also sometimes with that sort of thing, you tend to more think that you're the doer. Instead of following Krishna's lead. I mean, if you think about Prabhupada, Prabhupada was, you know, he was making an effort, but Prabhupada was given a ticket. He was given a free passage, and he was given a sponsor, and then he was given a place to stay. And
he had the owner of his crew.
Yeah, had the order of his guru. Prabhupada had the order of his guru. He made some. He certainly made some effort, but he also went with what Krishna gave him, and he expanded as Krishna gave him. I mean, Prabhupada did take on projects without knowing how he was going to pay. Like when they took 26 Second Avenue, he only knew how he was going to get the rent for 1 month. But, you know, look, if you're renting a place and you can't pay the rent, then you leave. It's not. Yeah. Okay. We're supposed to be reading according to our plan here. We're looking at the process of surrender. Children's laughing is such a nice sound, isn't it? It's definitely one of the sweetest sounds. Okay. Devotee told me, I haven't done the research myself, that children laugh an average of 200 times a day. Wow. And that the average adult laughs 20 times a day. Oh, really? Saying that thing. Really? There is a lot of research how laughter cures diseases and that 10 minutes of laughter is equal to like an hour and a half of vigorous exercise. Yeah.
There are laughter clubs in India.
Oh, yes, there are laughter clubs. There's one sannyasi in ISKCON who teaches laugh yoga.
Yes, yes, it's very popular now in Portugal.
Oh, really?
Yes. No, they do series of exercises to make you laugh. They do
stuff.
Everybody laughs. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I can teach you some of those if you like, but not now.
From the belly.
Yeah.
Is that a big question?
Everybody's laughing now.
Sorry? Oh, yes.
That's one of the rasas with Krishna, you know? Laughter. One of the rasas. One of the secondary rasas. So we're supposed to look at text 57. I don't know if we'll go all the way to 78 because that's kind of a different topic. So let's, if you have a Bhagavad Gita, if you don't, I'll just read this. So, read from 57. In all first I'm just going to read through the verses, and I'll go back in and look a little bit at the purports. In all activities, just depend upon me and work always under my protection. In such devotional service, be fully conscious of me. By the way, this 57 to 60 is the same as what other verses? First of all, in what chapter? Well, there is a verse at the end here that is the same as a verse in chapter 9. But these 57 to 60 are the same as what verses? In what chapter? I told you all. It's one of the things I told you. You know, whenever somebody repeats something, that means it's important. And this is something that Krishna repeats. Almost. Chapter 3.
Oh, I've got 331.
That's right. That's right. So this is almost an exact repeat of chapter 3, text 31. In all activity, that means it's important. That means it's important. One of the main ways we remember anything is repetition. And one of the main ways that a teacher signifies what's important. Just like if you look in a book, just like in this book, the people who did this book didn't understand this principle very well. But just like in this book, some things are in bold. Mm-hmm. So things that are in bold we know are important. Things that are titles are important. And just like this page, I was telling Atul Krishna Prabhu, we can understand that what's on this page is not important. Which is interesting because actually it is important. I said I didn't even look at this until after I had been teaching for over a week. Because we all know that if something's in light, this is in gray font instead of black. It's in gray, and it looks like it's about a size 10. So gray font size 10 tells us this is not important. So a good teacher, a good organizer, knows the signals. And of course, different cultures have slightly different signals, but knows what are the signals. This is important, this is moderately important, this is not important. Sometimes they'll come right and tell you, like Krishna says, look, what's the use of all this detailed knowledge? You don't need to know this stuff. And hey, Arjuna, this is very important. But one way of signaling that something is important is whether or not it's repeated. You notice in the Isha Upanishad, remember there was those three verses that were repeated again? Did you just cite different words? What verses were those? 9, 10, 11 were repeated in? 12, 13, 14. So 9 and 12, 10 and 13, 11 and 14 were almost identical. So when there's things that are repeated, you know they're important. So these verses here are almost identical to what was in the third chapter. So then you know, oh, this is an important concept. Now, we do have the principle that in a lot of the Shastra, important things are put in the middle, which is interesting. But we also know that people tend to remember what they hear at the end. Psychologically, people tend to remember what they hear at the end, which is sometimes poses difficulty for a teacher because the end are often questions and answers. And the questions and answers often go off topic. And they may deal with things that the teacher doesn't think is that important. But oftentimes people will remember what was discussed in the questions and answers at the end rather than your ending point of your talk. Make sense?
Yeah.
All right. So things that are repeated, things that are at the end, things where the teacher says this is important. So this is something that's repeated. In all activities, just depend upon me and work always under my protection. In such devotional service, be fully conscious of me. If you have a Bhagavad Gita, you can read along with me. I'm just reading the verses. If you become conscious of me, you will pass over, out loud, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditioned life by my grace. If, however, you do not work in such consciousness but act through false ego, not hearing me, you will be lost. If you do not act according to my direction and do not fight, then you will be falsely directed. By your nature, you will have to be engaged in warfare. Under illusion, you are now declining to act according to my direction, but compelled by the work born of your own nature, you will act all the same, O son of Kunti. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, O Arjuna, and is directing the wanderings of all living entities, where seat is on a machine made of the material energy. O Sayana Bharata, surrender unto him utterly. By his grace, you will attain transcendental peace in the supreme and eternal abode. Thus I have explained to you knowledge still more confidential. Deliberate on this fully, and then do what you wish to do. Because you are my very dear friend, I'm speaking to you my supreme instruction, the most confidential knowledge at all. Hear this from me, for it is for your benefit. Always think of me, become my devotee, worship me, and offer your homage unto me. Thus you will come to me without fail. I promise you this because you are my very dear friend. Abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. I shall deliver you from all sinful reactions. Do not fear. We're going to stop there. Okay, so you pointed out 9th chapter. So what was the verse here that was repeated in the 9th chapter? No. Manmana bhava mad bhakto. So that must be a very important verse because, first of all, it's in the middle section of Bhagavad Gita. It's in the bhakti section of Bhagavad Gita. And then it's the penultimate verse. It's the second to last verse of Krishna's main instructions. After that, Krishna gives instructions as to how to teach the Bhagavad Gita, and then we have Sanjaya's concluding remarks. No, I'm not a Muslim. I just don't want to get brown splotches over my face. Okay. So let's see this most important instruction of Krishna and the process of surrender. So, depend on me, he says, under my protection. And conscious of me, depend on me. Under my protection, conscious of me, and
This is very much like Isha Upanishad. This is what you should do. This is what happens if you do. This is what happens if you don't. Okay? If you do, you go over all the obstacles. Remember we had that slide of the guys jumping over the barriers? Remember that? Does Krishna say if you do this, there won't be any obstacles?
No.
Okay.
Or else we wouldn't have to overcome
it. Yeah. And loss will be not hearing and having false ego.
But the obstacles won't really be like obstacles for us, right? I mean,
you'll be able to walk over them.
Yeah,
it's not that there won't be any. Okay. Now the other thing he's going to say, if you don't, if you're not doing it, you'll be lost. If you're not doing it, you'll have the same behavior, but a different what?
Result?
A different result and a different consciousness. Okay, you're going to have the same behavior because the behavior is coming from your? No, the behavior is coming from your? Nature. Okay, now here he's saying what? And how? Here he's saying the results. Now he's going to go back to what and how. Krishna in the heart. Surrender to him utterly. Now he's going to give some more results. If you do, you'll get transcendental peace, and you'll go back to Godhead. Okay? After this, do what you like. So here he mostly explained the not, and here he mostly explained the do. Here he didn't explain the not at all. Okay. Now again he's saying, you know, but you're my friend. So, I'm going to tell you the what again. I'm going to tell you the what and how again. Alright? Think of me. Become my devotee. I'm supposed to be a Yak Tail fan.
What's
this? I'm supposed to be a Yak Tail fan, a chamara.
Oh.
It's probably not a very good chamara. I'm supposed to be a ghee lamp. Think of me, become my devotee, worship me, and offer obeisances to me. And surrender. Give up all other dharma. And give up all fear. Okay, so I have a little outline of these verses. He's saying, depend on me,
work under my protection, be always conscious of me. If you do that, you'll overcome all obstacles. If you don't do that, you'll be lost. Instead of hearing me, you'll hear just the false ego. And you know what? You won't be able to give up your behavior anyway. It's not that you're going to be able to change your behavior. So it's not going to work, Arjuna. You're going to end up doing that. You can do the same thing that you want to run away from. You'll just get a different result, and you'll do it in different consciousness. Krishna's in your heart. Just surrender to him. If you do that, you'll get peace, and you'll get the supreme and eternal abode. So not only will you overcome obstacles, you get peace. So all right now, here there's what to do. What to do is take your nature. Take the nature that you have. The nature we have in this body, is it our eternal nature?
No.
Take the nature you have, use that for Krishna, depending on him, being under his protection, being conscious of him, surrendering to him. If we do that, we'll cross over all obstacles, we'll be peaceful, and we'll go back to God. If we don't do that, we won't be able to give up our nature anyway. You'll still do the activities that are according to your nature. Your nature is not going to change, but then you'll be listening to your false ego instead of to Krishna, and then you'll just be lost. You'll be without direction. Okay, now do what you want. So what's the choices? The choices are to use your nature for Krishna or use your nature not for Krishna. Those are the choices that Krishna is giving Arjuna. That's, I'm going to boil down to the essence. Use your nature under Krishna's direction, conscious of Krishna for Krishna, or use your nature for your false ego. That's it. He's just telling you reality. If I give you this glass of water and I say, you can drink the water and be healthy, or you can chew the cup and break your teeth. Anyway, let me just finish this and I'll get to that. Then he says, do whatever you like. It's up to you. I'm not going to force you. It's your choice. What you can't choose to do is say, I'm going to give up my nature and have another nature in this life. That you can't do. That's not an option. No, I didn't. Oh, he gave a PowerPoint. He loves doing PowerPoints. Yeah, I'm going to go to, I had to make a choice, either go to class this morning or he's also giving class in the afternoon as the third in the series. So I chose to continue with my third in the series and skip the morning. Yeah, when I heard he was giving class, I'm like, okay, I'm going to his class this afternoon. Yeah, now that this is my last day of teaching, I should be able to go to class every morning. All right. Anyway, people think, and I see devotees think this way too, and I know I've emphasized this, but I've emphasized this because I've seen it's a real problem. That people think the way to be Krishna conscious is to have a different nature. That basically is impersonalism. It's like, you know, I'm suffering because I have a personality. I'll just stop having a personality. I'm suffering because I have a form. I'll stop having a form. I'm suffering because I'm having relationships. I'll stop having relationships. It's kind of Buddhism. But the tendency is very strong, I think. Do we all have that tendency sometimes to do that? Yeah? This thing is making me suffer. Okay, I'll just stop the thing. I give the example of, you know, the room is dirty, you blow up the room. Solves your problem. You don't have a dirty room anymore. Or people say, I'm chanting offensively, I'll just stop chanting. It does solve the problem. You're not chanting offensively anymore. That's true. So that's not an option. Whatever body and mind we're stuck with in this life, we're stuck with in this life, you know? If you don't like it, don't get another material body and mind, basically. But what you got, you got. It's like you get on an airplane, you can't jump out over the Atlantic Ocean. Now you can, but that's really not a very good idea. It's not recommended to jump out of your plane over the Atlantic Ocean. It's really not recommended. So you got to tolerate. And if you made a wrong choice about what plane to get in, you know, the best you can do, Prabhupada says, make the best use of a bad bargain. The best you can do is not get on another plane like that after it lands. So if it was foolish to get a material body and a material mind and have a material nature under the modes, don't do it again. Okay, but well, you can't jump out of the middle. That's just not possible. What is possible, but we see it very rarely, is to transcend your nature. That is possible. That is possible. And Krishna says early in the Gita that people like that have no duties to perform. They have no reason to do their duties, and they have no reason to give up their duties either. You remember that? And what do such people usually do?
Follow the duties to show example.
Yes, they follow their duties to set an example. So usually such persons continue to follow their nature, even though they're no longer bound by it, just to set an example. Sometimes such jivan muktis, such liberated souls, live as avadutas. Sometimes they live without doing any action in this world. They live like crazy people. Correct? Correct? Yes? You all know some people in the scriptures who were living like that?
Bhaktisiddhanta
outside of society?
Even Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati for 10 years did that.
Not exactly. I wouldn't say he was living like an avaduta. An avaduta is somebody who's... he was just sitting and chanting.
Yeah.
But that's not an avaduta.
Vamsidas Babaji.
Vamsidas Babaji was definitely an avaduta.
Where is from Bhagavatam, the snake?
Yes. An avaduta is somebody, you know, they may not even bathe. Jed Bharat was living like an avaduta. Maharaj Rishabhdev in his last days. Maharaj Yudhisthira, the end of his life, was living as an avaduta. Somebody who's completely outside society. Completely. You know, they look like they're a mentally ill homeless person, basically. And they're often mistreated by others. Such a thing should only be done if you're 100% liberated from the modes of nature, and if that's what Krishna wants you to do, figure that none of us will ever do that. So generally people who can live like that, they don't need, like Vamsidas Babaji, he didn't need to eat. For 4 months he wasn't eating, sleeping, passing stool or urine or bathing. So if you can do that, then you can live as an avaduta. But even such persons who can live like that, they usually live like ordinary persons to set an example. They usually do eat and they usually do sleep at least something. Even the Goswami slept a couple hours a night. Prabhupada slept 3-4 hours a day. They usually do something just to set an example for society. I mean, we see Srila Prabhupada did not, once he started his preaching movement, Prabhupada did not follow severe austerities. Prabhupada didn't even do full fast on Ekadasi when he was running the preaching movement. Well, he was trying to set an example. So anyway, it is possible to transcend your nature. That is possible, and that's our goal, is to transcend our nature. But what many times neophyte devotees do is they just think, if only I had a different nature, then I'd be more Krishna conscious. If I had a different material nature, then I'd be Krishna conscious. What happens if you want a different material nature? What will you get? Huh? You sure do have to take birth again. Exactly. So if you waste your time, if you're thinking, I'm too quiet, I'm really too quiet, I'm really shy, if I get up in front of a group to speak, my hands start shaking, and, you know, I just can't be a preacher, and unless I'm a preacher, I can't be Krishna conscious. I wish I was, you know, like those bold preachers, and why do I have this kind of reserved nature, and it's not any good, and I wish I was a really fired up preacher. You have to take another birth.
And so the fired up preacher thinks.
Then you can be a fired up preacher. And sometimes a fired up preacher is thinking, oh, why can't I just be quiet and shy?
Why do I get myself into this?
Why do I get myself into all these troubles? Why do I have this loud, obnoxious nature? And I'm always thinking I'm so proud and better than everybody else sitting at the front of the group. Why can't I just sit in the back and keep my mouth shut and be humble? And then again, you have to take another birth. So, please, I'm begging all of you with a straw between my teeth, please, don't lament what nature you have. Don't hanker after anyone else's nature, and don't lament what nature you have. What nature you have, you have. You won't have it eternally. You didn't have it eternally. It's a temporary thing. Don't worry about it. But use it for Krishna. Use it properly. Use it under Krishna's direction. Use it appropriately. One of my sisters really liked the word appropriate. So just like there are certain clothes we wear when we go swimming. When you go swimming, you might just go in your petticoat and your choli. But you don't walk around the campus like that. Or when you're taking a shower, you bathe naked, but you don't walk around naked. It's not appropriate. So it would be kind of strange if you took a shower with your sari on. Right? That would be a little odd. You wouldn't get very clean. So different things are appropriate, and you use your nature appropriately. So each of us has aspects of our nature that have places where they can be used and ways they can be used and places where they can't be used. And we know what we can do and what we can't do. Yes?
Could you explain a little bit what it is exactly what we do to attack to Godhead from what is ourselves as a person?
Yeah, everything.
Oh. What is it that we take?
Have you ever been in a drama?
Yes.
When you were in a drama, were you able to really get into the character? So when you're in a drama and you really get into the character might have something to do with who you are off the stage. It might not. You might play a character in a drama that's very similar to who you are, and you might play a character in a drama who's very, very different from who you are. I was once waiting in the doctor's office, and I read this article about this guy who was married to Meryl Streep, a very famous actress. He said, "I feel like I've been married to thousands of different women." Because every time she's in a new movie or a new drama, she takes on that character. And she'll even when she comes home, she's still sometimes acting like that character. Prabhupada gives this example. So when you're in a drama, you want to perform the drama nicely. Even if you have the role of a demon, like Chitraketu took the role of a demon as Ritrasura. Bhishma took the role on the wrong side. Whatever role you have, you want to do it nicely. Vibhishan also had a demon role to play, partially at least. He's the king of the demons. So whatever role you have to play, you play. You know, if you're in the Ramayana play and you're playing Sharpanaka, I used to play Sharpanaka, or Sharpanaka, some people say. You want to play it nicely. You don't want to play it like, "Oh, Ram, would you marry me?" That's not going to work. Yeah. If you're playing Ravana, you got to really play Ravana. You know? And at the end of the drama, you take off the costume and you wash off the makeup. And hopefully, unlike Meryl Streep, you also let go of the character. You don't take it home with you. So, but we're not just talking about taking off the costume and becoming nothing. So what do you take with you? That question will be answered as you wake up. So as you wake up, you'll start to find out, well, wait a minute, who am I? So before you wake up, it's just a general thing. Okay, I'm a devotee of Krishna. I'm a servant of Krishna. It's very general. And when you wake up, you start saying, oh, who am I? Bhaktivinoda Thakura talks about the 11 items. Your name, your age, your form, what colors you like to wear, your particular service. Each of us has an eternal form, an eternal age, an eternal name. A home, family, a particular service that we do. Just the other day hearing Prabhupada say, you know, we're all looking for a permanent apartment. Not that you get one apartment and then you have to move. My son just rented a new place. He has an 18-month lease. And he said, I'd like to stay here at least 5 years, really. Who wants to move all the time? So we're looking for a perfect place that we don't have to move from. Of course, if it's not a nice place, then you do want to move. But we're looking for a nice place we don't have to move from. So all that becomes revealed. When you wake up, you see, who am I?
So you're not taking any of your characteristics that you might have now?
Unless just by coincidence some of them happen to be the same. You might be playing a role in the, like, let's say that your eternal form is female, and right now you happen to be female. So that's coincidence. Does that make sense?
I'm just wondering that the things that you might, like some people are, for example, artists, some people are teachers, you know, and or have studied for many, many lifetimes probably to get to a point.
Transcendental knowledge and realization is eternal. What's eternal is the mood of bhakti. That you never lose.
So it's not like that Bach is now playing, if he would be Krishna consciously in the spiritual world, it's not
music.
Music.
Well, he might be. But again, that would be just coincidence.
Yeah.
I heard that Prabhupada said he came from heavenly planets.
Could be, I don't know. Yes? That she said, you heard Prabhupada said he came from the heavenly planets. I said, I have no idea. Yes?
Manaji, what would you say to devotees who, joined in the early days and now they're in their 50s and they've come to some sort of understanding that because I worked for the society, I didn't really engage in according to my nature, and they're like 50, 55 years old, and what would you say to that?
Because always like start from now.
Yeah, so that's like if somebody at that age goes back to university and gets a degree just to be engaged in a particular field, that's okay?
Why not? Start from now. But your nature also has to do with how old you are.
Well, that's why.
So there's several aspects to nature. I mean, if you want to look at in terms of, let's look in terms of varna and ashrama. So varna particularly applies to the grihastha life. But varna is a whole life. Although it's particularly manifesting grihastha life, because varna has to do with how you make your living. But ashram has to do with age. And, we have definitely had a problem in ISKCON that because we preach renunciation, we have many people who denied their changing nature according to age, and then they get married when they're 45 or 50. That's a very serious problem. That definitely is a spiritual disturbance. And it's... In that regard, we're influenced by two things. We're influenced by the outside society. The outside society says marry as late as you can or avoid marriage altogether. That's a very strong pushing from the outside society. And we're also affected by the fact that Prabhupada really preached renunciation and that if you can remain single and celibate your whole life, that's better. But Prabhupada never said marry as late as possible. He said if you're going to marry, you should marry young. He was very emphatic. If you're going to get married, Prabhupada said, if you're going to get married, you should marry before you're 30. And in the Bhagavatam, he said, women should be maximum 16 and men maximum 24 to marry. So that's an example. Our society is really, really messed up in that regard. We're a mess. We're just a mess.
How do you
best deal with it? You're 50 in your 50s. And I don't know. Shan Hare Krishna. I don't know. It's a mess.
Because
it's really a mess. And it's causing people, it's really hindering people's spiritual lives.
Yeah.
I mean, I just had a devotee who's 38 come to me and say, okay, mother, I'm going to get married, please help me. And it was obvious to us since the day he walked in the door that he should have been married. I mean, it was obvious to everybody. And I said to him, Prabhu, you've been stealing from the grihastha ashram all this time, you've been a brahmachari. he's been flirting with women all along. He's always done that. And he wrote me an email and said, it really hit me. But, now he's marrying at 38. Of course, he's not married yet. Now he's got to find a girl. That might take a while. And then you have your first kid when you're 40. I mean, another devotee talked to me recently and said, I'm 60 years old, and now I want to renounce. But my kid's 13 years old. I got a 13-year-old kid. And, what do you say then? You were supposed to get married younger and have your kids younger. You can't anymore. That's too late.
So you said earlier on,
it's definitely causing a problem.
Yeah, you said if we don't engage according to our nature...
It'll come out anyway.
We can't transcend it, which is a big ask. Then it'll force us to take another birth.
What will force you to take another birth is if you're trying to change your nature. If you want another material nature, if you're thinking, I don't like the fact that I'm like this and I wish I was like this and like this, that'll force you to take another thing. Because then you can...
That lamentation I've seen...
Lamentation also. Lamentation's a sign in the mode of ignorance.
Engage according to my nature.
You know, I was counseling one 58-year-old woman who joined at 30. She said, I'd already had so many relations with men, and I figured I was done with that whole thing, so I didn't want to marry, and I was determined I wasn't going to marry, and now I realize that it was a mistake, and I should have gotten married. Typical story.
Yeah.
I said, it's too late now. You're 58. It's done. I said, the door's closed. It's done. I said, you can't do it dharmically anymore. And she was really happy with, you know, she was kind of happy with the discussion, and the next day she was ready to kill me. She was so angry. She was so angry with me the next day. Why can't I get married? I can be Christian. I said, fine, then marry. I said, you know, you can do whatever you like. Go ahead and do it. I said, but you can't do it dharmically anymore.
But so many leave Krishna consciousness.
Because of that kind of thing, I know. But, you know, you can't tell people what they're not ready to hear. You just can't, you know. You can try. It doesn't work very well. I know. It's really a problem. It's really, 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 really a problem. And there are some people like me, Bhakti Vikas Swami, Bhakti Vijayapurna Maharaj, there's a few others who really, you know, make that point. If you read Brahmachari and Krishna Consciousness, Bhakti Vikas Swami says if you're going to get married, marry young. So there are some people who are preaching like that. You know, that 95, 99% of people are going to marry, and if you're going to do it, marry young. Huh? Oh, I said a lot. There are people preaching like that. But there are a lot of other people who are preaching in other ways, and I see that it's mostly coming from the outside society. It's certainly not coming from Prabhupada. It certainly wasn't the way Prabhupada preached. Prabhupada did not preach artificial renunciation. He did not tell people to marry late. It certainly isn't coming, from Guru. It isn't coming from Shastra. That is definitely a big problem. And some of it is just bad association, but most of it's pride. I'm more advanced than I am. I'm in a different level than I am. Exactly. That's the typical ISKCON problem. Very widespread problem.
In Australia, so many have left and they've even married outside.
Oh, yes. Because what's happened is by the time they get married, their desires for it are so strong that often then they would just want to marry a non-devotee. I mean, it's a serious problem.
And also all the devotees that...
The reason they gave for getting married at the later age is they cannot live alone. So they need a company.
Whatever reason they give, it's that behavior is a result of misunderstanding the teachings of Shastra. So whatever nature you have, it's not good or bad. It just is. You know, like Arjuna thought it would be better to live by begging.
But then it is definitely...
And a very simple example was told to me by one of my godbrothers. If you want to get from here to Delhi, what's the fastest way?
Flying.
You can also take a train. You can take a car. You could walk. You could ride a bicycle. You could go by ox cart. So suppose you say, well, flying is the fastest way. But you don't have enough money for a ticket. So you sneak onto the plane. So where are you going to end up?
In jail.
And guess who's going to get to Delhi faster than you? The guy who's walking. No, that's a little different. So if you think, I'm going to be a sannyasi, but you're not fit for sannyas, you know, then you just get arrested or your plane crashes. Or if you say, I'm going to, you know, plane's faster, so I'm going to fly a plane. But you don't know how to fly a plane. Then you're going to crash. Then you'll be in the hospital. So then you'll be in the hospital and the guy who's walking will get there faster. So what's faster depends on you. You can say that a plane is faster. Well, that depends.
But then marrying late is definitely a hindrance to the spiritual development.
Generally, yes.
isn't the reason that women are marrying late because there are not so many qualified husbands anymore?
I think most women are marrying late also because of propaganda. The majority that I see, they're saying, first I want to get my service together, first I want to get some training. That's outside propaganda. That's the same thing as first I want to get my education, first I want to get a career.
Yeah.
It's just you're saying it in a sounding like a Krishna conscious way. The other reason, another reason people are marrying late is we don't have facility at ISKCON to help people find husbands and wives. So we tell people, don't find your own husband or wife, but we're not going to help you find one either. And then how do you do it?
No, they are creating these internet sites.
Yeah, but that's not everybody wants to put up their picture on the internet.
Yeah, that's really.
You know, I mean, I wouldn't want to do that.
I mean, come on.
I wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah.
Actually, my son has written a matching. We tried to solve this. My son has written a matching program, but we can't find anybody to host it. He's not willing to run the service. But he wrote a program for matching that could be used on an internet site, so you wouldn't have to put up your picture and. I'm wonderful. Would you marry me? I mean, that's a little weird.
That's so. Yeah, if you don't have to put your
picture, I think it's a
better.
Little strange, you know?
Yeah, then it's like just based on people will just.
Yes, I thought it
well,
was
and also, who's going to be really honest in something like that?
That's so.
Who's really going to be
like
honest?
It ends up working like the rest of the matching programs outside.
Yeah. So anyway, I worked with him for a while. We did one that was very scientific, but we can't. Right now, nobody will use it. Anyway, that is another reason. Another reason people are marrying late is that we have a very strange situation where we tell people, now don't look for your own husband, but we won't find you one either. And that really doesn't help. That's kind of a problem. So that's definitely another reason.
Well, the women, they strongly feel that they have to take the initiative and take care of themselves. You don't feel that they can trust the men.
Yeah, well, that's also a problem. Anyway, we could probably list about 40 reasons why we're having these problems. But it definitely makes spiritual life harder. Because that means people are not properly engaged according to their nature. And it means their nature comes out anyway. But it, as Krishna says, but it comes out in a form that's not so helpful. And therefore, we see people in the renounced order who are flirting with members of the opposite sex.
Oh,
we see it all the time.
Yeah,
we don't. Okay. And we see people. We don't need to get into details. Don't talk about individuals. But and we see people who are in, you know, renounced ashrams, who are surrounded by adoring members of the opposite sex, who are, you know, and they're taking service and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, so that's... We have had sannyasis who practically, on a subtle level, live like polygamous kings. Sorry to say. But we have. But they have lots of adoring young women. You know, who are dealing with them emotionally like a husband. And you can't tell the women this either, if any of you are in that category. I'm sorry, but it's hard to tell the women that also. And a lot of times these women, you know, you'll say, you know, you're dealing with this sannyasi or with your guru like he's your husband. Why don't you just get married? And they usually get very offended. I remember several women I saw like that. One of them wasn't young. Who were dealing with their spiritual master emotionally like a husband. And it was funny, but as soon as they actually got married, that just stopped. It was really interesting, you know. And they were saying, I'm not doing that. I said, okay, fine, whatever. And one of them actually became adverse to the person once she got married. It's like she didn't need him for her emotional needs anymore, and she became negative towards him. So we see that kind of thing. We definitely see that kind of thing. That people then just say, hey, just get married. Or I heard about, you know, one brahmachari. I'm sure there's more than one, but one particular one I was hearing. He has his own place. He has his own bank account. You know, then get married.
Is it true that there are not anymore so many qualified brahmas in ISKCON?
I don't know. Yeah, I've never done a survey of all the men in ISKCON and categorized how qualified they were. She said, is it true that there aren't very many qualified men in ISKCON? I said, I don't really know. I haven't haven't done a research project on this, you know. Are you serious?
The Bhakti Sadachar class, he said that...
yeah, there are more qualified women than men.
That, yeah.
With all due respect, I'd like to see the study.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the many things that I learned from getting a PhD is that if you're going to make statements like that, you should have some solid research to back it up. So I'd really like to see, you know, what was their criteria for qualified? How did they define qualified? Who did they interview? What part of the world were they in? And
yeah, so that depends on so many.
Yeah, well, that's, as I say, that's another problem. But anyway, the result of all that is not very favorable for people's Krishna consciousness, because people end up exhibiting, and by the way, it works the other way too. If people naturally have a renounced nature and artificially stay in the grihastha ashram, that's not very beneficial either. We have some stories in the Shastra of people whose families forced them to marry when they were natural renunciates, like Raghunath Das Goswami, for example. You know, and then you have to think of his poor wife. I've often thought about his wife. You know, you marry this guy and he just runs off. I mean, of course, it's transcendentally nice. There was another, I can't remember who he was. His parents had got him married really, really, really early, and he never spent time with his wife, and finally his guru ordered him. I don't think so, but it could be. I'm thinking it's Narottam Das, but I don't remember who it was. I'm not sure. Anyway, his guru said, you know, stay with your wife. Was that then him? And then he spent one night with his wife, but he didn't even touch her. And they said to his guru, okay, I slept with my wife. Well, he did, technically he did. And then his guru said, all right, I give up, you know, just renounce family life. But again, you think about the wife. Yes, it is. But sarvadhamam pritcha mamekam saranam vraja. If you're actually on that platform, then you can do that. So we'll get to that also. But so that should also not be there. If somebody has a naturally renounced nature, they shouldn't be forced into family life.
For men or for women?
For women also, but most women are not naturally renounced. That's rare.
Would you say Mirabai would fit?
Mirabai is a good example of. She's an excellent example. She was already an elevated platform. She was already married to Krishna.
Shankaracharya asked his mother at the age of 7 to allow him to leave the house.
He took sannyas at 8.
Yes. And he went to the river and he was taking a bath. His mother was on the bank and he just started shouting that the crocodile has caught my leg and I'm just going to die. Now, at least now, please give me the permission. And then the story says, yes, the mother gave the permission and then the crocodile left the leg. And then he...
Madhvacharya also took sannyas when he was 12.
Yeah, at the age of 7.
Madhvacharya. So that also was there. I mean, we see some people who, you know, artificially are in household life and they're terrible grahasas. They're just terrible. They just, you know, all they want to do is just go to the holy places and... They're useless grahasthas. So sometimes you see that too. So people should be engaged. You should be honest. What is your actual nature? But we have many more problems with people artificially being renunciates than people artificially being grahasthas. I think the artificial grahasthas is like, you know, 0.5%. And the artificial renunciates is a huge, huge, huge percentage. And then you get to be 58 and say, I want a baby, you know. And it's like, well, it's a little late, lady, you know.
About some situations that I know of, maybe it's a bit out of line, but some I know of some men that were married during Vriyasa life, and when they came to an age where they should enter into Varnaprastha, leave the wife, and they get a younger devotee. That would be their daughter, and then they go on and preach that you should renounce spiritual life, and then they get up and...
She said some people, you know, they leave their wife when they're middle-aged and say, I'm going to be renounced, and then they just marry some young girl.
It's very private.
Yeah, I know some cases like that, and that for me is so strange.
Well, then obviously they weren't ready to be renounced, were they?
And no, they just renounced the wife.
So then it's you know, again, you end up doing it in the wrong way.
The Buddha actually, when he renounced and when he returned, his wife was angry on him. But then when he explained his situation, then she said, as a Kshatriya, I'm coming with you, and so our son. So both of them, they took Diksha from him.
Mm.
And they just surrendered to him, because in the history there is no, again, the mentioning of his wife and
his child. No mention.
They just surrendered.
They just accepted.
Yes.
Well, if you have a husband like Buddha or, you know, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, then very, very nice. So we're looking at several things of nature. Of course, nature, as far as whether you're a household or a renunciate, changes during life. And then we're also looking at your personality or varna. All of those sorts of things we're looking at in nature. And some of those things change during life, like whether you're a renunciate or whether you're grihastha, that changes. And some things are set for your life. So certain things are not going to change.
There just seems to be such a misunderstanding in such a long time that advancement in Krishna consciousness equals renunciation. But that's not necessarily the case.
Well, that's true and that's not true. So advanced, Prabhupada often says you can test your advancement in Krishna consciousness by how detached you are from sense gratification. Specifically, how detached you are from sex life.
Yeah, but you don't have to change ashram.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that, just like Pundarik Vijayanidhi, he was an opulent, wealthy householder. Ramananda Roy, whoa. You know, so at an external level, Arjuna was a householder till the very, very end of his life. He had four wives. He wasn't just a householder. He was a prince. He was a polygamous householder. Of course, the Pandavas had a really odd household arrangement.
To say the least.
They really, I mean, if you actually sit down and think about it, it's really, really odd.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the Draupadi had five husbands, and each of the men had at least one more wife.
Yeah.
So it was definitely very unusual. I mean, even in those days, it was a very unusual situation. But, you know, he wasn't asked to give up his household life. Krishna didn't say give up your household life, give up your occupation. So renunciation is different. Real renunciation and what surrender is for whom am I doing it? Who am I conscious of? We're talking about the difference between passion and goodness. It's not that people who are, it is true, Krishna says that in passion people are very active. But it's not that someone just sitting down is in goodness and somebody running around is in passion. I was just hearing, again, Prabhupada speaking, listening to the conversation, Prabhupada speaking to this Christian priest or minister, and the minister was talking about just stopping, you know, sitting and meditating, and Prabhupada said, yes, that is neutrality, but we are interested in activity. He said, we're interested in spiritual activity. We're not interested just in neutrality. And so many times Prabhupada would say, you have not seen the Vaishnavas like Arjuna and Hanuman, you know, who are very active in Krishna's service. So it's what's motivating you. Who are you listening to? As Krishna says here, not hearing me, hearing the false ego. Who are you hearing? Are you hearing Krishna or are you hearing your false ego? Renunciation means I don't want to enjoy anything separately from Krishna. I don't want to be a thief anymore. We talked about yesterday. I'm not trying to satisfy my needs by being the master of the material energy. That's renunciation. Renunciation is I just... What's it? I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll just read from a few of these purports, little bits, little snippets from the purports, then we'll take a break. Okay, so 57. Now this is interesting. This is one of the times when Prabhupada says things. He said, a servant has no individual independence. He acts only on the order of the master. Now Prabhupada also says, remember we read in Ishopanishad where Prabhupada said it's not that we don't have any personal initiative. You remember that? We do have personal initiative. But here it sounds like you don't have any. Then he says, a serving acting on behalf of the Supreme Master is unaffected by profit and loss. So that's why I really like this business analogy.
57?
57. If I'm working for a business, if I'm working under a boss, I don't do something independently. Either I'm ordered by my boss or I get permission from my boss. I may get permission. I may go to the boss and say, hey, I've thought of a way that we could increase the company profits by 3 times. What do you think? Tell me, does an employer like an employee who does that? Oh, absolutely. What's better, an employee who just does what they're told, or an employee who comes and says, hey, I have a really good idea for how we could make things even better? The second is definitely better. My Prabhupada says the first class servant knows what the master wants without the master even telling them. Second class servant does what they're told. Third class servant doesn't do what they're told. Oh no, third class servant does what they're told after arguing. And the 10th class servant doesn't do what they're told. So first class servant knows what will please the master without the master having to directly say so. Generally that takes some time to get to know Krishna. What does Krishna really want? Therefore there's a training period. Prabhupada says at least in the beginning one has to be under strict rules. Right? Like if you hired me as your cook, so on day one I'm not going to know what you like, isn't it? I have to work for you for a while. Maybe I have to work for you for 5-6 months before I have a really good idea what you're going to like without you telling me. I've come to know because I served you this and you said, oh no, I don't really like that very much. You served me that, you know, I served you something else and you wanted more. I have to get some idea what do you like. So second class does what they're told. Third class does what they're told with fighting and screaming and arguing, and 10th class doesn't do what they're told. But your best employee is one who does take personal initiative, right? Correct? Isn't it?
Use your intelligence.
Definitely. You can't. There's only so much you can do with just yes people. That gets boring too. Everybody says yes Prabhu, yes Prabhu, yes Prabhu, yes Prabhu. Prabhupada was so happy when people used their initiative to think of ways of spreading the movement. But then you ask permission, don't just do it. I was in a temple once where the temple president was also a sannyasi and he was also the guru of most of the devotees in the temple. He used to talk about how he really liked yellow, how yellow was his favorite color. So like a lot of the women would wear only yellow, which was talking about strange relationships between women and a sannyasi. And anyway, one of the men one time, when the guru was out of town, he decided, my guru really likes yellow. So he bought some bright yellow paint. This is a true story. I was there. And he painted all of the buildings bright, bright yellow. Like the what's on the border of your sari there. You know. And the guru comes back and he's like, did I tell you to do that? Oh, anyway, they stayed that way for quite a while. Nobody wanted to spend the money to repaint them. So at least one should ask permission. Either one gets an order or one asks permission. One doesn't just do things. You know, I think it'd be nice if the temple was yellow. But to speak, if the authority says, you know, I want you to paint the buildings yellow, and then you think, he probably would really like it better if they were blue. He probably doesn't mean that he wants yellow. After all, blue is Krishna's color. That would be so much nicer. Oh, Krishna. So anyway, that's how I understand this. That's like working for a company. You know, I don't just go and do things. Of course, I did do that one time. The person I did that with is here now. It's on the GBC now. But the town president, we were having a big festival. We were installing some deities. And I said to the town president, why don't we invite everybody? You know, we don't have a good mailing list. Why don't we invite all the congregation and we can invite the media also, get a lot of publicity? He said, I'm not going to tell you who this is because he's even forgotten. I reminded him. He said, did I do that? I said, yes, Maharaj. And he was a brahmachari then. And he said, I'm sorry, we can't have women in charge of anything. He says, if a man will do it, you can work under him. And I thought, well, that's strange. I was thinking, why would it be more proper for me to work with a man than to do it myself? That didn't compute. Anyway, you know, I asked a couple times, and he said no. So then he went to India. He came to India for the festival. So I asked my husband, I said, will you give me the money to just do it? He said no. So I went to the temple treasurer and I lied. And I said, the temple president said that I can do this. I only asked for $5. I said, can I get $5? You can tell how long ago this was. So the temple president came back like 2 days before the festival. And there were about 2,000 or 3,000 people at the festival and all of the press. And I walked up to him and I said, okay, see, this is what I can do. Now, would you please let me be in charge of doing the mailing list? He said, no, I don't want a woman in charge of anything. So that was the only time I did that. I'm not sure if my doing that was good or bad, but anyway, I did do that once. But in general, don't do things like that. There's one exception, of course, with Ramanujacharya. You know that story? Ramanujacharya was told by his guru, there's this mantra, don't tell anybody, it's a secret mantra.
Yeah,
he went and gave it to everybody.
Yes.
And his guru said, why are you disobeying my order? You're going to hell. And he said, I'd rather go to hell. Let me go to hell, but I want to liberate everybody. Yeah. And he said, okay, you've known my real heart. Or like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, don't disturb the minds of the ignorant. And Prabhupada says the devotees are more merciful than the Lord because they know the Lord just doesn't want to put these devotees into any trouble. But please be careful. Okay, because Prabhupada does say later in this purport, he says, one should, however, note that after doing something whimsically, he should not offer the result to the Supreme Lord. So it's not that, well, I'm just going to do whatever I feel like, and then I'm going to offer that to Krishna. And how to think about Krishna? He says, one should think, I've been appointed to discharge this duty by Krishna. He said, then naturally you're thinking about Krishna. Krishna's asking me to do this. I'm doing this for Krishna. I'm taking care of my husband and my children for Krishna. I'm making money for Krishna. I'm cleaning my house for Krishna. I'm boiling the milk for Krishna. I'm doing the laundry for Krishna. This is my duty for Krishna. Okay. Next purport. Prabhupada says, the person in full Krishna consciousness is not unduly anxious about executing the duties of his existence. So this is what I talked about yesterday with the needs. If you really work for a good company, you don't need to worry about your own needs. If you're employed by a really good company, they will give you a salary. They will give you medical insurance. They'll even give you vacations. They'll make sure you're taken care of. Some companies even provide housing. Some of them even provide social events for their employees, correct? So not worrying about your own needs doesn't mean artificially repressing. It means that I really have faith that Krishna will take care of my needs. The Prabhupada says, the foolish cannot understand this great freedom from all anxiety. Remember, Krishna says you'll get peace. The result of surrender is you get peace. The result of surrender is not necessarily that your life will be perfect the way you think it should be, but the result of surrender is that you'll have peace. Prabhupada says, don't falsely think you're free of the modes of material nature. So this is like if you try to quit the game, but you're not actually renounced. You know, if you say, okay, I won't take care of my husband anymore and my children, I'll just go to Mayapur and sing, but you're not actually on that platform, and you think, oh, I'm free of the modes of material nature. Okay. Purport here, Arjuna was considering himself master of his actions as if he were directing the good and bad results of such work. Can you decide whether the results of your work will be good or bad? Can you control that?
No.
No. So this is being detached again from the result. Okay. If one refuses to act under the direction of the Supreme Lord, he is compelled to act by the modes in which he is situated. Anyone who voluntarily engages himself under the direction of the Supreme Lord becomes glorious. Now here's another very similar statement. Arjuna was not the supreme knower. His decision to fight or not fight was confined to his limited discretion. In other words, when I'm deciding, should I do this, should I do that, should I do this, should I do that, I don't know if the results are good or bad. How do I know? I can't know. Then I'm bound by my limited discretion. Here's talking about what we're like with your body. As soon as a living entity is placed in a particular body, he has to work under the spell of that bodily situation. Again, you cannot change your nature in this life. A person seated in a high-speed motor car goes faster than one seated in a slower car, although the living entity is a driver may be the same. So you just see honestly, what do I have? Do I have an airplane? Do I have a bicycle? What do I have? And don't lament, I wish I didn't have a bicycle. Use it. Okay? Individuals always under the Lord's control, therefore one's duty is to surrender. Surrender will relieve you of all miseries. That doesn't mean that you don't get a cold. That doesn't mean that your husband doesn't leave you for another woman. It doesn't mean that you're always rich. What it means is you have peace. That you have peace. That even when you have a cold, and even if your husband runs off with another woman, and even if you lose all your money, and even if your house burns down, even if your child dies, or you have an autistic child, you have peace. It doesn't mean that your life will all work out exactly the way you think it should work out. But it means you'll always have peace. I was talking to one lady, not here, whose husband's leaving her for another woman. And she's an Indian lady, and it's just devastating for her. She's completely devastated. She has a son who's a teenager. And I was saying to her, just depend on Krishna for meeting all of your needs, even your emotional needs. And then she says, well, if I do that, does that mean my husband will come back to me?
Oh, yeah.
I said, I don't know, but you'll have peace. You get peace. Or does that mean that, I'll have a nice living situation and I'll have enough money? I said, I don't know, but you'll have peace. So that's the freedom from all kinds of material miseries. You'll be released from all miseries in this life. At the end, you'll reach the Supreme Lord. I am 62. Now I'm in 63. God does not interfere with the little independence of the living entity. Remember we talked about, Prabhupada said, you should know what's yours and what's not yours. So what's ours? That little independence, that's ours. That's ours. That Krishna doesn't take away. He's going to take away your body, my body, all of our bodies. He's going to take away our bodies. He's going to take away all the things we learned in this life. Our saris, our jewelry, our children, our home. Even your Nisingadeva Maha necklace. Aww. She goes like this. Not now, Lord, okay? He's going to take away all this stuff, But he's never going to take away our independence. That's ours. That's ours. And really nice here, surrender to the Supreme Personality of God. It is in the best interest of the living entities. It is not for the interest of the Supreme. Krishna is not motivated selfishly. There's no selfish motive. Whatever he gets from us, he can supply himself. Like he created all those cowherd boys and calves. Whatever it is that I can give to Krishna, because I can give something to Krishna nobody else can give. I have my own relationship with Krishna that nobody else has. He can't get that from any other jiva, but he can get it from himself. He doesn't need me to give it to him.
So this Catholic notion that God and the devil are like fighting for the souls, it's kind of silly looking in that view, no? It's not that they are.
Can
like
you hold that?
Scoring.
Can you hold that, and after the break we'll talk about that?
Okay.
Because I can't talk about that in 10 seconds or less, and I want to take a break very soon.
Okay.
So the idea is that Krishna is not asking us to surrender. In this world, when someone asks us to surrender, it's because they want to use us. More or less. Even devotees, unless they're 100% pure, it's going to be there to some extent. You know, there's going to be some exploitation. Has to be, by definition. But from Krishna's point of view, there's no exploitation. There's no exploitation. He's asking us to surrender because that will benefit us. He's asking us out of love. And then Krishna says here, okay, but I'm going to tell you. So he could have left it at that. He could have said, okay, now I've explained everything. Now you decide. And then he stops. But he was filled with love. And this verse, mama, blah. Okay, we're now taking a break.
Okay.
And meet back in 15 minutes. Okay, all right, Krishna. 15, that'll be my wife.